Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today, we are spending the whole show on the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jacques Paisner and David Moore. They are co-founders of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, which is happening this week, starting tomorrow. It's October 19th through 24th, Tuesday through Sunday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So this is the second year that you were doing the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, not to be confused with the Santa Fe Film Festival. How did you start all of this, and what's your vision for it?
Well, we started it because we're at heart filmmakers, independent filmmakers, low-budget filmmakers. We love independent film, and we came to the startling, shocking, and sad realization that there was really a shortage of exhibition platforms for independent cinema, not only in New Mexico, but really everywhere, and that there were an increasing number of independent projects going into production, and that these projects would need a place to screen. And we decided that we would be honored to involve ourselves in providing a place for these film artists to show their work to a public audience.
And so you choose from sort of all available genres in independent film, from animation to narrative films, shorts, full-length films, documentaries, the whole thing.
Absolutely.
International films. You know, we're really excited to have a full program with just a ton of variety. We're showing films by young filmmakers who have never been seen. We're showing a documentary about Norman Mailer that's only screened at Boston. This will be the West Coast premiere. And
we're West Coast?
Certainly. Close enough.
Close enough. A lot closer than Boston.
Right.
And, yeah, we're showing a film called Animal by A.C. Lloyd. She sold everything she owned. She's a University of Denver student. And she'll be here Saturday night with her whole cast and crew to introduce the picture and do Q&A afterwards.
Yeah, it's you know, it really rose out of our frustration in trying to get an audience for our own feature film that we produced. We realized just how difficult it is to get into a film festival and to get screened, and also how heartbreaking it is to be repeatedly rejected by other exhibition platforms, other independent film festivals. I mean, and we just wanted to ameliorate that heartbreak for as many people as we possibly could.
And we let out a call for entries and a mission statement that seemed to really strike a chord with filmmakers and producers alike who were doing edgy political films and experimental ideas, and they were able to contact us, and we got a ton of support from the community in New Mexico as well as the filmmaking community in all over the world.
All over the place. We got submissions from well over 20 countries by now, I think.
So how do you select? I mean, you don't want to give people the heartbreak of rejection, but at the same time, you have to have some criteria. It's
an inevitability. If you make a movie, you know, some people are going to like it. Some people are not going to like it. Some fests are going to reject it. In fact, most festivals will probably reject your project, especially if it's feature length or if it deals with anything controversial
edgy.
Or edgy.
You're kidding.
And
I thought that's what these things are all about. I thought film festivals were the place where you get to see the controversial stuff.
In the 70s, it was very much like that. And, you know, it was a break from the studios and something very new and cool. And they had a very good run that kept on for quite a while. But lately, it's become a situation where film festivals would rather pick something that won a prize at another film fest or showed at some big film fests like Tribeca or Sundance, rather than a film that their programming team thinks is special and new. And what we think it's about is giving not only new artists a chance, but giving audiences a chance to see something new that they may not have the chance to see anywhere else. That's why half our program this season is world premieres. And
you've got a lot of films and a lot of world premieres.
Yeah, we're very proud of that. Not only of our large program, but we're proud that such a high proportion of it is local films. And as local filmmakers, we had a really hard time getting so much as a nod from anyone in the scene here in New Mexico. And we're especially proud that we're world premiering so many films. Because, these movies, as they move forward, wherever they go, we have the satisfaction of knowing that they began their journey through wherever it ends up, whether it ends up with distribution or wherever they go, they take us with them as the fest that gave them their first shot and premiered their film. And that's a great honor to us.
Yeah, we feel like it's really special for a film's journey to begin here in Santa Fe. We're showing 80 films over 6 days.
80 films. Shorts, longs, mediums.
Yeah, all different lengths. 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 90 minutes, 100 minutes.
You've got a one-minute film.
We have a one-minute film.
It must be pretty good.
It's adorable.
It's really cute, yeah.
And we're going to be talking to some of the other filmmakers, including one of the animators who made a great film called Fred. We'll be speaking to a bunch of people from the film festival. You're also going to be showing tomorrow night Salt of the Earth, which is a film that has screened here in Santa Fe to great acclaim.
Salt of the Earth is such an important film, not only for New Mexico history, but for the history of film. It was directed by Herbert Biberman, who was one of the Hollywood Ten. And he and several members of the Hollywood Ten, after being released from prison, came to New Mexico to shoot this movie. They were told to leave Silver City at gunpoint and went to Grant County, New Mexico, and made the picture, which is the only blacklisted American film in history. The U.S. government deported the lead actress, Rosario Revueltas, to Mexico, accusing her of being a communist, and they had to smuggle the canisters back in unmarked boxes to finish the picture.
Oh, my goodness.
Then when they went to edit, like something like half their editors were FBI plants. So it's for us, it's, we don't think that Salt of the Earth can screen too many times in New Mexico, honestly. And we think that everyone should see it. And
what's it about?
It's about it's really actually very deep. On the face, it's about workers' rights, and it's about socialist issues surrounding miners and blue collar issues like that. But by the end of the film, it really moves into the realm of women's rights and feminism and equality between the sexes and men and women working together, which in the context, in the cultural context and the time of when the picture was made is really kind of remarkable, we think.
When was the picture made?
It was made in 1954. It's based on an actual miners' strike in 1951. The filmmakers spent since it was blacklisted, they spent the next 8 years suing the U.S. government unsuccessfully. And,
for their freedom of speech rights?
Yeah, and for the government trying to crush the picture. And, it was released on like 50 screens or something like that. But it managed to win awards in Europe and acclaim, as a cult classic. We love it, and we're so happy to be able to show it for free to the community here in Santa Fe, where, both Dave and I grew up.
So what are some of your favorites this film festival, this Santa Fe Independent Film Festival?
Boy.
Well, there's Ambassadors of Hollywood, is just this hilarious documentary. We're showing it on Sunday. The director will be here to introduce it and do Q&A. It's about the people who dress up as Shrek, Elmo, and Batman and Spider-Man on Hollywood Boulevard. And it's just this brilliant character study of all these wild, crazy people and their lives as their
lives both on and off Hollywood Boulevard. By day they're dressed up like superheroes and taking photographs with tourists and haggling with them, and by night they're they're schizo-bipolar, they're working actors, they're artists of different stripes, and it's really just an insight into this sort of quirky, weird, strange set of folks that, I mean, it never occurred to me.
You follow Elmo, and he was working on Wall Street, making big money, and he gave it all up to go and dress as Elmo.
You wouldn't believe the stories these people have, and they're all very different. None of them can really be classified or pigeonholed. And it's just a great, great topic for a documentary. It's really, really funny.
There's the guy who dresses as Shrek, and he when he takes his Shrek mask off, he looks even more like Shrek.
And, of course, of all the people who dress up on Hollywood Boulevard, they chose the weirdest ones among them.
Yeah, there was actually – it's not the first time someone's made a doc on the subject. There was another documentary. I forget the name of it. But the director of Ambassadors told us that they were shooting around the same time. And from what I've heard, they didn't get the interesting – cast that the guys that did Ambassador of Hollywood.
Yeah, the first picture was very safe and very boring and very, perfect for a film festival like Telluride. This one really gets into the deep nitty gritty of who these people are and, you know, their lives as being mental patients and prisoners, and now they're taking pictures with Japanese children on the boulevard.
We're going to be talking to an animator in a little while, and some documentarists. And there's a film called Animal by a first-time filmmaker who sold everything she owned in order to make this not super short film, but not full-length, not feature-length film either.
The young lady who produced that film, her name is A.C. Lloyd. She produced and directed it. She sold everything she owned to make the project. She's sort of the extreme case of the artists that we're looking to promote and foster relationships with and exhibit art for, because she's extremely passionate. She has great vision, and we think that we're sure we haven't heard the last from her. She is not going anywhere. She's obviously very committed to the craft and the art form, and she's willing to sacrifice and take risks and gamble in the interest of pursuing her art. And that's something that we really respect, not only as artists, but just as human beings. You know, you can't help but give a nod to somebody who's willing to go that far in the interest of pursuing their passion and their ambition.
And this is a post Iraq War post-traumatic stress syndrome story.
Well, it's to me, it's almost, there are aspects of it that are almost biblical. It's sort of it's a strange sort of, I don't want to say coming of age, but there's definitely a metamorphosis that occurs for the protagonist in the story, with him dealing with his war experience and re-entering society. Feeling alienated, feeling the need to repent for the transgressions he committed in war, and it all sort of comes together in this desert landscape. And we just thought it was a really brilliant freshman feature effort by a very passionate and committed, talented artist, and so we're proud to screen it.
And she'll be here to introduce the picture Saturday night with her whole casting crew.
Her whole casting crew is coming as well, yeah.
Now, you are giving a Lifetime Achievement Award to Russell Means.
Yes.
Russell Means is a great actor. You know him from The Last of the Mohicans, was one of his greatest roles. Natural Born Killers. And Dave and I are also just awe-stricken by his life as a rebel and a revolutionary. And we're not only honoring him as an actor, but also for the work he's done as a rebel.
Well, and that's the reason that it's a Lifetime Achievement Award and not an Actor's Award or something related directly to film, because what we feel Russ has done that's so incredible is he's really been he's been a fixture in American culture in one way or another for probably the better part of 35 or 40 years. I mean, he was involved with the whole thing at Wounded Knee, and he's coming from a place of being a rebel rouser and an anarchist and also a legitimate Hollywood actor and film star, we feel that that shows a great amount of talent and flexibility in just being able to be all those things to so many different types of people, you know. And so we think he should be honored for that.
How are people who are making films, independent films, none of these are studio films, that's why it's called the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. How are they managing to do it? Okay, so we've got somebody who is selling everything she owns. You've got some other people who are calling in favors because they're making studio and TV films on the side. Some people are just buying equipment and doing things in a room or outside their house.
Ben-Hur Sapere, he was a former personal filmmaker to the Shah of Iran. He was a student of Ingmar Bergman. He came to L.A. to be a movie maker and mortgaged his house to make his $65,000 picture, The Desperate, which has, you know, won numerous awards and been very well received. And, you know, that's just one story. Misha Klein,
we'll be talking to in just a few minutes.
He worked
on
that. Yeah, Fred. He worked on Fred for 10 years.
It's an animation.
Again, sold everything he owned, packed up all the puppets and moved them from like one state to another to finish the picture in Albuquerque. And we're just so proud to be showing it.
Well, once again, he's an example of somebody who's really, obviously really, really committed and passionate. And when you see the animation that he did, Fred, I have never seen anything like it in my nearly 30 years of watching cartoons or animations of all types.
It's a stop animation.
And it's all stop animation, which most people probably know is extremely time-consuming and tedious to produce. You know, everything's digital these days, so we saw this great, you know, 10-minute stop animation piece, and then we talked to him about the trials and tribulations and work that he'd had to do to get it in the can, and we couldn't help but show it. We think it's really brilliant.
The Santa Fe Independent Film Festival is happening starting tomorrow night with a screening of Salt of the Earth and continuing through Sunday. All the screenings are at Warehouse 21. The website is santafeindependentfilmfestival.com. Anything else that you want to let our listeners know about?
Yeah, Digby Wolf, creator of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, has just agreed to give a talk on dramatic writing for film at 2 p.m. on Wednesday. And we just added that, as well as...
Oh, that's fantastic.
We're so excited. He's such a genius. You know, he's 81 years old. And, you know, everything you see nowadays, Saturday Night Live, The Chappelle Show, it all came from this brilliant idea that he had for Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. Also, John Moritsugu, who's this great indie filmmaker, has just agreed Wednesday at noon to talk about indie filmmaking. He's won prizes at Chicago Underground and New York Underground. He's played at Festival de Cannes, Toronto.
Didn't he win the New York Underground Film
Festival?
He did. Yeah.
And he is a recent transplant to Santa Fe, and we're just so happy to be friendly with him and have him coming to educate the community.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being here, Jacques Paisner and David Moore, co-founders of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. It's the second year. Hope to have many more years to come. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I plug the website?
SantaFeIndependentFilmFestival.com.
And thank you very much.
There we have it. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Jules Hart. She is producer and director of the documentary Pink Smoke Over the Vatican, which screens at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival at Warehouse 21 this coming Thursday at 4 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So this is all about women priests in the Catholic Church, which I didn't even know existed until I saw your film. People who have been basically kept out of the church hierarchy, but some women have managed to become priests anyway.
Absolutely. They've kind of taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and there are male bishops in good standing with Rome who have secretly ordained these women and brought them into the apostolic succession, so they feel that they are in alignment with the Roman Catholic Church now.
One thing that I've always wondered, I mean, whatever you might think of not ordaining women priests, a lot of people see it as a kind of vestigial sexism of the Catholic Church, that they won't do that. And I've always thought, well, why don't they just go to the Episcopalians or the Unitarians or somebody else who is happy to embrace women priests? But what I saw in your movie, that there are people who really grew up in the Catholic tradition for whom it's a calling, and they want to stay inside of that church, which I find fascinating and sort of perplexing.
Well, it's true. As one woman says in the film, she says, I'm British, you know, I can't leave being British because I don't like the Queen. And that's how they feel to some extent. They are Roman Catholic, and one woman even said, it's in my DNA, you know. They feel very connected to this church. And another point is they feel that if you leave, you can't change the church from outside. The only way you can make real reform is by staying.
Another thing that I didn't know about was that there is a lot of evidence, including new archaeological evidence, that there have been, in the earliest history of the Catholic Church, lots of women priests.
Exactly. All of these discoveries have been made in the past 100 years. They're just being re-looked at, and they are reinterpreting the, like, say there's a tombstone of a that says Presbyterissa, which means woman priest. They were saying, oh, it's the priest's wife. But so they're reinterpreting these things, and they're finding frescoes, say, in the catacombs of women actually in the Eucharist. So they now, women scholars are coming in and saying, wait a minute, that's a woman priest. And we have lots of evidence of it. More and more and more is coming to light.
Tell us a little bit about the story of the woman who was ordained in an underground church in Czechoslovakia during the Soviet era. That's an amazing story.
Isn't that? What a courageous woman. What a courageous man who ordained her. Yes, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia, they were atheistic, and so they stopped people from openly celebrating their religion. So the church had to go underground, and many of the priests were imprisoned or deported or killed. And so what happened, there were so many women in prison that they decided, and there were nuns in prison, and they could not get any sacraments. So they decided the only way to bring sacraments to the women in prison would be to actually ordain a woman priest. So Bishop Felix Davidek actually did that, and Ludmilla was one. There were actually seven women that were ordained. She's the only one that's come forward. And so for 20 years, this was her job. She ministered to women and men who had no access to a priest.
And what's amazing about that is that the Vatican, rather than saying, oh, how wonderful that people in prison are getting ministry under the communist regime, they totally condemned the whole practice of even having these few women priests under the circumstances.
Exactly. You know, I'm sure they felt very betrayed by that. Here they'd served for 20 years. And all of the men that he ordained in that period were ratified, but the women were told, you know, thank you for serving. It was only in a time of emergency, but you know that you're not really a priest. So that must have been devastating.
Who were the Danube Seven?
This was a group of seven women who came out of a larger movement that started in Austria. It was called We Are Church. And they wanted many reforms in the church, not only the ordination of women. So they were working towards many reforms. And the pedophilia had just begun to surface in Germany and Austria. And they decided to go ahead and said, you know, we've been preparing for women's ordination since the 60s. after Vatican II seemed to have opened the church to this idea, and nothing has happened. And here it is, 2000. And so they did find male Roman Catholic bishops who also believe it was very unjust not to have women be priests, and they ordained 7 women secretly on the Danube River in 2000. And the movement has just grown from there.
And what's so interesting is there's a couple of examples in your documentary. We're talking about the film Pink Smoke Over the Vatican, of women priests being ordained on boats so that it can be in international waters, and they're not subject to whatever prosecution, I guess.
Well, yes, there were several reasons they decided to do them on ships, and one of them was so they would not be under any certain archbishop's jurisdiction so that they couldn't stop them. And also for security reasons, this way they could make sure they knew who was getting on the boat, and therefore nobody would try and stop them. It would be kind of a closed venue. And also no Roman Catholic Church obviously would allow them to do this on their property.
It's so interesting. Some of the women in the film are real social activists and
yes.
people who go out and into the field and work with the poorest of the poor and who fight for justice and so on. And others are real. I mean, one is a sort of self-described, I've always been a good girl, kind of conservative people who never would have gone online for, you know, gone over the line for anything except
right.
for the fact that they had this calling in the first place and they kind of had to.
Exactly. No, you'll see a great range of different people, and they absolutely, the one thing I hope that comes across in the film that I felt in meeting them was this deep call. I mean, these are not crazy women. These are not fanatics. These are people who, under any other circumstances, would not have come forward, except, as you said, there are a couple of activist women. But frankly, this is a deep, quiet call that they couldn't ignore any longer. A lot of these women are in their 60s, and they have felt it for years, and they finally just said, this is my opportunity, I am going to be ordained. And they followed that call.
Another thing that I had never really thought about is there's a lot of women who are Catholic women who want to go to confession, but they just don't feel comfortable confessing what's been going on in their lives, especially if there's, for example, sexual abuse or anything like that, to a male priest. And there is a real demand for women priests just on the level of somebody to confess to.
Oh, absolutely. And this, I hope, is more in the past. But as you saw in the film, one woman who counsels women who've been in abusive relationships, they've gone to their priest, and their priest, you know, since divorce is forbidden by the church, they tell them to go back to their abuser. So it's sending someone back repeatedly into situations where they're being abused. And hopefully women priests would have a better understanding. I mean, male priests, at least in the past, they grew up in seminaries from being very young teenage boys. They've had no real connection to women except for women that serve them, the nuns, you know, who take care of them and make their food and take care of their offices. So they really don't have real relationships with women, you know, and know what they go through in this kind of situation. And also imagine the girls that are being incested by their father or their brother or their uncles. You know, can they go and tell that to their priest? They're not even supposed to be having sex. It's a very double-edged sword. It's very hard. So I think having a woman to minister to these people would help tremendously.
The policy that the church, that the Catholic Church upholds, that the Vatican upholds, of A, not ordaining women priests, and B, requiring celibacy of their priests, seem just so hopelessly outdated and pathetic, but also really self-destructive, because who really wants to be a priest anymore? I mean, it's amazing to me that these women want to be priests, that anybody wants to be a priest at all, yet they never update their policies.
Oh, it's very, very true. All the seminaries are closing, and the nuns that you see now, they're all old. I mean, nobody wants to have this very difficult calling. I'm not saying celibacy is always difficult. Many of the women in the film were nuns, and they love that path. In fact, they feel that celibacy is a gift, but it's only a gift if it's what you're being called to. So, no, that is one of the things the women in this movement would love, is for the church to open its doors to married priests, because there are many priests who've left to marry who would enjoy coming back and ministering. And it is, I agree with you, I think it's hopelessly outdated. I think it's time to make these changes and bring the church into the modern world.
How did you come to make this film?
Oh, a woman actually approached me, the one who was the good girl. she had seen an article about me in a local paper talking about my interest in making documentaries, especially about women and about empowerment, you know, and spirituality. And she said, I'm going to be ordained a deacon in the Roman Catholic Church, and is that a story that would interest you? And initially I said, not really, because I'm not Catholic, and I didn't really understand what excluding women from ordination, how huge an impact that has, not only on the 1 billion Catholics, but also to our society in general. So once I met her and saw her call and met some of the other women, I said, no, this is a story that I need to tell.
Do you see any evidence whatsoever that changes are afoot?
Only in the laity, frankly.
Yeah.
The church seems to be really harshly punishing these women. They've all been excommunicated, and so have the male priests who have also been excommunicated. And that's one of the points in the film. The Pope came out, I guess, in 2008, talking about the gravest crimes against the church. And one of them is pedophilia, and the other one, on par with it, is the ordination of women. And also, the punishment for ordaining women is stronger than the punishment for pedophilia, where the
men... And they cover up the pedophilia.
Exactly. The men who've committed these crimes have not been excommunicated. None of them, but all of the women have been excommunicated. So it says something about fear of women or... it speaks to something very deep in this church.
The film is called Pink Smoke Over the Vatican. Jules Hart is the producer and director, and it screens as part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this Thursday, the 21st of October, at 4 in the afternoon at Warehouse 21. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for your interest.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Please stay tuned.
I'm very happy now to welcome Rebecca Schanberg. Her film, Do No Harm, is screening as part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this coming Wednesday at 7:30 at Warehouse 21. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is a story of whistleblowers in a nonprofit hospital in Georgia who brought forward this huge scandal involving extremely wealthy wealthy hospitals who were gouging uninsured patients. Who were these two men, these two whistleblowers?
Well, they were actually hospital. They were affiliated with the hospital. One of them was a surgeon, and at one time he was the chief of surgery there. And the other one was his, he had an independent practice, and this was his practice accountant and practice manager. And so the two of them kind of worked together. One did the financial work, and one did the kind of external work about what was going on at the hospital.
How did you find out about them?
It was interesting. They had eventually gotten to Dick Scruggs of Big Tobacco fame. The lawyer who actually brought down Big Tobacco, and they had gotten to him to try to file a class action lawsuit on behalf of uninsured patients around the country. And when they reached him, he actually hired a public relations firm to do work for him around the country as big hospital systems were being involved in these lawsuits, because he knew that would cause a lot of controversy. And someone I knew at that PR firm actually began telling me about the story, and I got so interested in it that I and really interested in them because their story was so incredible that we flew down to Atlanta to meet them, and that's how it all started.
What were some of the practices that this particular hospital was doing?
I think the main thing that really got them engaged in the story was that the hospital itself was using different levels of what they call master charge rates to figure out how much to charge patients. And when you're insured, they give you a discounted master charge rate. I'm sure if you've gotten a big bill from the hospital, when your insurance actually pays it, they pay a fraction of that charge usually. Maybe it's 50%, maybe it's a little bit more. What the hospital was doing was using the higher number to charge all uninsured patients. So basically, the people who had the least protection and the least amount of leverage were getting charged the most money, and they were going bankrupt.
And these are nonprofit hospitals that get big tax breaks, and they're supposed to provide something in return for being nonprofit and for getting such big breaks.
That's right. That's right.
What is it that they're supposed to provide? What's their end of it supposed to be?
Well, it's community benefit, and I think the issue really is that that's a very loosely defined term. They are supposed to be responsible for their communities, working with their communities. And at least in this case, and this isn't true for every nonprofit hospital, but for many, in this case, the hospital became an independent entity, really operating for money. Its officers made a ton of money, had contracts with the hospital to make more money, and it just basically wasn't really looking out for the community anymore. It had employees whose wages were being garnished by the hospital itself. And it really, there were a lot of things that could have been done by the hospital to take care of people in the community that they weren't doing.
So basically, the hospital's own employees didn't have health insurance, and then when they got sick and needed medical services in their own hospital, they were actually suing their own employees and garnishing their wages.
They were suing their own employees, and they actually, many of them did have health insurance through the hospital, but it was so bad that they didn't have good coverage, and they had to, some of them, we actually have one in the film who ended up having to go to a soup kitchen to get food for her kids. She was bringing home so little money every week that she couldn't support them, and the hospital knew that.
You know, during the whole movement leading up to healthcare reform, there were so many stories about, for example, insurance company executives who were living like kings with just untold riches while the company was failing to or refusing to pay claims for sick people who were utterly vulnerable. This isn't even about health insurance. This is about the hospitals themselves, but it's like the same story.
Well, I think what's really what I've heard from advocates around the country, the film has actually been screened by advocates all over, is that what was really addressed by healthcare reform was health insurance reform. And hospital financial reform hasn't actually happened yet. The hospitals, although there are practices and there are different kind of laws in place and protections in place for patients around the country now, and many of those will go into effect within the next 6 months. And advocates are working very hard to make sure that some of those protections actually get played out on the hospital level. For example, patients are not allowed to have their bills sent to collection agencies. That's one protection. But the issue is, really, if you go back to what the hospitals are billing, those numbers are what hasn't been looked at.
Right.
Because those numbers are so hard to decipher. What's the right number? What does it really cost the hospital to give an MRI? Those kinds of numbers. So that's really the issue. Once you change those numbers and you go right back to the beginning of where these charges are coming from, then people won't go bankrupt. You don't need protections because those numbers won't be so high.
And there are plenty of other countries that control and regulate those numbers. And MRI, we did an interview about this a year or two ago with T.R. Reid. An MRI in Japan costs the same in every single doctor's office you go to because that's a regulated number.
Right, and I'm not surprised. I mean, there are people who came forward while we were making the film who told us they were hospital suppliers. The guy who would sell the slings to the hospital when someone would break an arm, he would sell them for $7, and the hospital would sell them for $120.
Right.
right out of its dispensary, you know, and it's that kind of a thing. So I'm not surprised to hear that.
What was so interesting about this is that the hospital that you focus on in your film, we're talking about the film Do No Harm with Rebecca Schanberg, the filmmaker, the hospital, Phoebe Putney, what really didn't handle itself in a very intelligent way. They came out basically wielding threats and money and so on, but they didn't know that the press would really report on them doing the things they did, and it kind of turned against them.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that, because I think they really didn't. They really had a sense of arrogance about them, and they still do. They really don't think they can be touched. It's a pretty amazing thing.
What percentage of the hospitals in the U.S. are nonprofit hospitals, and do we have any sense of how many of them are engaging in this kind of thing?
No, I don't know the exact numbers. The last time I asked someone the number, they said about 85% of the hospitals in the United States are nonprofit. And there are, some of these practices are just standard practices, and to a large degree, some of it isn't actually malicious. It's just that the financial side of the hospital is completely cut off from the human side of the hospital. They don't actually realize that what they do creates this type of a result. But some of them do know, and they've made a choice to become profitable so they can build new buildings and all kinds of other things. And we actually covered one in the film here in Chicago, where we're from. The Northwestern Hospital, which is a fantastic hospital, and I actually gave birth to two children there, they have rebuilt their entire campus at a cost of over $1 billion in a decade. And their charity care is less than 2%. They're actually cutting it back. It's a very well-known thing that Northwestern does not give good charity care. And that's the type of thing where a hospital that is so successful in a city that people don't want to mess with it. They don't. It's a good hospital, has incredible quality of care for those who can afford it, and people don't want to bring down a hospital like that. And the hospitals claim that they don't have enough money to give away more. And so it's a fight that's almost impossible to prove, because the hospitals can use different sets of numbers for different things. And they can say that they can use the inflated number to say that they gave this much charity, and their cost can be a lot lower. And it's a very big, very difficult battle to fight, I think.
This film illustrates to me, among other things, the incredible importance of the media in doing investigative reporting, and these little newspapers in Georgia that you portray are working on a shoestring budget, but they still did their work. And it and the importance of documentary films like yours, it points out how scary the apparent imminent demise of newspapers really is.
I agree. I mean, one of the papers we had in the film that you were referring to, I think, went under right after we interviewed them, and it was terrible because, you know, that was 6 weeks later and they were gone. And I think you're right. I think it really, when you try to show this story to the major news media, they have a really hard time covering it, because it isn't easy to prove, and because the resources that they would need to devote to this kind of a piece are just enormous, and they don't have them anymore.
Rebecca Schanberg is a filmmaker. Her film is called Do No Harm. Its screening is part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this Wednesday, the 20th of October, at 7:30 at Warehouse 21. It's a very important film to see, and it's really well done. I thank you so much for making it, for being with us here on KSFR.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome Misha Klein. He is the filmmaker who made a short animated film called Fred, which screens at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival this coming Saturday, the 23rd of October, at 5:45 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a short animated film about a funny, terrific character named Fred. It's a what we call a stop animation film. You are working with actual three-dimensional objects, like little dolls or little, you know, people. Tell us about the nature of this animation technique, how it works.
Well, I'm just going to correct you. It's not a doll.
I know, sorry.
Puppet.
No,
thank
you.
The only reason I say that is because, you know, a lot of clients, I've done this for about 15 years, and they say, oh, would you just, you know, just make the dolls? And a puppet is a fine Swiss watch compared to a doll. No, I'm kidding.
okay.
It's, yeah, it's just made with articulated, armatured puppets, characters that are touched one frame at a time, pushed around, fondled, and you just move it a little bit, take a frame, move it a little bit, take a frame. So it's a traditional style of animation, known as stop motion animation. But yeah, Fred is a puppet. He's got a ball and socket armature, and so he holds his pose.
So how do you get, I mean, you move it a little bit, you take a picture, you move, so what is it, 30 frames per second?
For television, oftentimes it is, but film standard is 24 frames per second.
So 24 frames per second. So to make several minutes of film, you're getting into a lot of individual motions. How do you, doing all these tiny little motions, get the gestures, get the body language, so to speak, of these little animated creatures to be so expressive?
You think pose to pose, you think about the performance. You know, every gesture holds a little bit of a little nugget of something that you're expressing. So, you know, you can walk across the room and pick up a chair any number of ways. You know, you can do it like a stiff robot, or you can do it and express sadness or joy. And so it's just figuring out the poses based on sort of what, you know, what that pose is expressing. So I sometimes will videotape myself acting out a shot. And oftentimes the puppet itself just suggests a lot of things. You know, you just it looks great in a pose, and you just go with it.
You made this film over a period of years, moving from city to city. Why did it take such a long time?
I just made it on my downtime, my off time, my time between jobs. So, you know, I'd have a month here, a month there, but everything takes time when you're doing animation, especially stop motion. You have to build everything to a certain standard so it doesn't move under camera, and the lights have to be, you know, locked oftentimes to the set. And the puppets are tied down with, you know, threaded rod and nuts. And so everything can sort of hold its pose overnight. Or building the sets took time. Building the puppets took time. Planning out the shots took time. Writing the scripts took time. But I was still working. So it took me about 10 years to make Fred. But it moved from city to city in bicycle boxes. And the sets just pop together. They're just flats that I can screw to a table and then throw the lights up and attack another scene. So it did take quite a while, but, you know, everything needs to be relit and redressed and match. So it just takes time.
Now, do you have some inspirations among animators?
Yeah, quite a few. Ray Harryhausen's a huge one. I love the way he combines live action with stop motion. He had such a great touch. His characters just were imbued with so much life. And I think you can animators today can still learn so much from him. I love the old Warner Brothers cartoons, the old Fleischer Brothers cartoons. I think Fred is kind of a hybrid between a Muppet and a cartoon. He's really inspired by Warner Brothers. A lot of pose to pose, a lot of sort of hijinks. I thought about anticipation in the same way those old Warner Brothers animators thought about it, and I tried to have an old Americana flavor to it.
Right. Now, you work on this film for many years. You finish it. You send it out. Is there a market? Is your film getting seen?
I'm batting about 500. It's gotten into about half the festivals I've submitted it to, and so that feels pretty good. At the first year, you sort of keep it offline, I think, is what filmmakers tend to tell one another, is festivals don't want to be undermined as far as their legitimacy, and the last thing you want to do is have your film be sort of viral and out there. So the first year, I think you kind of get it into festivals, and you try to win awards, and you try to get it noticed. But that's, you make a film, so eyeballs see it, and there's no better place to see a film than a movie theater, so it's nice to get it into a film festival. And I think people still like to go to the movies and eat popcorn and sit in a dark room with other people, and then filmmakers like to smear themselves up on the wall, share dreams.
Are you working now on more animation?
For work, I've been writing stuff and brainstorming, but I haven't actually begun production on anything new. I'm just still kind of promoting this one.
Misha Klein is the filmmaker who made the animated short film Fred, which is screening on Saturday at 5:45 at Warehouse 21 as part of the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.